This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents In Farley Field, written by Rhys Bowen, performed by Gemma Dawson. September 1939. From His Majesty's Government to Civilian Population of Great Britain. For the duration of the war, the following 7 rules are to be observed at all times. 1. Do not waste food. 2. Do not talk to strangers. 3. Keep all information to yourself. 4. Always listen to government instructions and carry them out. 5. Report anything suspicious to the police. 6. Do not spread rumours. 7. Lock away anything that might help the enemy if we are invaded. Prologue. Elmsley, Kent, August 1939. It had been unusually hot all summer. Ben Cresswell could feel the sun scorching his thighs through his cricket whites as he sat on the clubhouse veranda waiting for his turn at bat. Colonel Huntley sat beside him, mopping his red and sweaty face. He was wearing pads because he was next up at bat. He wasn't as good a batsman as Ben, but he was team captain, and in village cricket, seniority often took precedence over ability. Only 2 overs before tea. Ben hoped that young Sims wouldn't make one of his wild swipes and be out before the tea interval. His head was singing with heat. His mouth felt dry. He closed his eyes and listened to the satisfying thwack of bat against ball, the drone of bees on the honeysuckle behind the clubhouse, the rhythmic clatter of a lawnmower in one of the cottage gardens. The scent of new-mown grass wafted on the warm breeze, mingled with the smoke of leaves burning on a distant bonfire. The scents and sounds of an English summer Sunday, unchanged for centuries, Ben thought. Polite applause directed his attention back to the match, where 2 white-clad figures were sprinting between wickets while a fielder ran to retrieve the ball, throwing it in too late. Another run. Jolly good, Ben thought. They might even win for once. Beyond the perfectly mown pitch, the spire of All Saints Church, where his father was vicar, cast a shadow over the village green. And on the far side, an old oak tree cast a similar shadow over the memorial erected to those men from the village who had died in the Great War. There were 16 names there. Ben had counted them. 16 men and boys from a village of 200. Senseless, Ben muttered to himself.
"Where's young Prescott, then?"
Colonel Huntley interrupted his musings.
"We could have used him today. He handles a fast bowler as well as anyone I've seen."
Ben turned away from the cricket pitch to look at the colonel. He was a large, florid man, his face weathered to a perpetual beetroot colour by a long stint in India and too much scotch.
"He's taking his flying test, sir."
"His flying test? Is that what the young idiot's doing these days?"
"Yes, sir. He's been taking flying lessons. He wants to be ready, you see. When war is declared, he'll go straight into the RAF as a pilot. He didn't want to find himself up to his neck in mud in the trenches like all those poor chaps in the last war."
The colonel nodded.
"That was a rum deal. Lucky for me, I was on the northwest frontier. Let's hope they don't make the same bloody mistakes this time."
"I suppose war is inevitable?" Ben asked.
"Oh, yes, absolutely. No question about it. That blighter Hitler's going to march into Poland, and we're honour-bound to declare war in the next couple of weeks, I'd say."
He spoke with the cheerfulness of a man who knows he is too old to be called up.
"We had one of those civil defence chappies round at the house last week.
They wanted me to dig up the back lawn and put in an air raid shelter. I told him it was quite out of the question. The back lawn is where the Memsahib plays her croquet. We're going to be rationed in everything else. You can't expect her to give up her croquet, too.
Ben smiled politely.
Yes, we had a similar visit. They delivered a lot of corrugated iron and the plans. As if my father has ever built anything in his life. He's only just learned to turn on the radio.
The Colonel eyed Ben critically.
So what about you, young fella? Are you planning on becoming a pilot as well?
Ben gave him an apologetic smile.
I'd like to, sir, but I can't afford the flying lessons at the moment. I'll have to wait to see if the RAF will take me.
The Colonel coughed as if he'd just realized that the son of a vicar recently down from Oxford and now teaching at a very minor prep school wasn't likely to have much cash to spare. He looked around, clearly trying to think of a topic to change the subject, and suddenly said in surprise,
"Hello! Here's a turn-up for the books. It's Lady Pamela. I didn't know she was interested in cricket."
Ben felt a flush come over his face and was furious with himself. Pamela was walking toward him with that easy grace, looking cool and elegant in peach silk. A strand of ash-blonde hair blew across her face, and she brushed it back as she spotted Ben. The men scrambled to their feet.
"Good of you to come to cheer us on, my lady," the Colonel said, offering her his place on the bench. "Sit here beside young Cresswell. I'm up next. Need to get the blood flowing into these old legs anyway."
Pamela flashed him a dazzling smile and slid onto the bench the Colonel had vacated.
"Hello, Pamma," Ben said. "I didn't expect to see you here. I thought you were in Paris with your sister."
"I was. Pa ordered me to come home. Actually, he ordered me to bring Margot home with me. He's sure war is about to break out any second, and he's scared she'll be stuck on the continent, but she's refusing to budge."
"She's so keen on learning to design fashions that the threat of a war won't move her."
Pamela's eyes held his in an amused smile.
"I rather think that a certain French count is the reason she doesn't want to leave."
"Crikey," Ben said, cursing himself for sounding like a schoolboy. "Your sister has fallen in love with a Frenchman."
"They are rather attractive, you know," Pamela said, her eyes still holding his. "So attentive. And they do things like kiss hands. Who could resist?"
"I hope you did."
The words came out before he could stop them.
"I don't go for the Gallic type myself," Pamela said. Then she looked around. "Is Jeremy not playing today?"
And Ben realized, like a punch in the stomach, that she had not come to see him after all. It was Jeremy. Of course it was bloody Jeremy. A picture flashed unbidden into Ben's mind. He and Pamela and Jeremy on a long-ago summer afternoon like this one, climbing the big oak tree at Farley Place, home of Pamela's father, the Earl of Westerham. Jeremy leading as usual, with Pamela close behind him, going up and up until the branch she was perched on was swaying violently.
"Don't go any higher," Ben had called.
She had flashed him a challenging smile. Then the awful cracking noise. The sight of Pamela's surprised face going past them, as if in slow motion, and then the thud as she hit the ground. It had taken forever to scramble down to her. Jeremy had reached the bottom first, jumping down beside her. Ben was last as usual. She was lying there, not moving. Suddenly she opened her eyes, looked first into Ben's worried face, then focused on Jeremy, and her eyes lit up.
"I'm all right. Don't fuss," she said. She had not been all right. She'd broken an arm.
But that was really the first time Ben had realized that it was Jeremy, not him, that she cared about. also how damn much Ben cared about her. So many memories from long-ago summers. There was a yelled, "How's that?" and a groan from the crowd.
"Damned young fool," Colonel Huntley muttered. "He will swipe at it, clean bowled again."
He got to his feet, but before he could walk out from the clubhouse to meet the dismissed batsman, there was a droning sound in the sky. Everyone looked up as a plane appeared over the hills, flying very low. The drone became a roar. The plane continued to descend.
"It can't be going to land here," Colonel Huntley exclaimed. "What is the fool thinking?"
But the plane was going to land. It skimmed over the large copper beach before touching down on the field, scattering cricketers and just missing the rolled green of the cricket pitch. The plane was painted bright yellow and black, like an overgrown wasp. It bounced across the grass and came to a halt in front of the clubhouse. Ben heard the colonel mutter,
"What the devil?"
But he didn't bother to answer. Before the pilot took off his goggles and helmet, Ben had known it was Jeremy. Jeremy's eyes were scanning the crowd. He spotted Ben, his face broke into a familiar grin, and he beckoned furiously.
"I've just bought her," he shouted. "Isn't she a beauty? Come on up for a spin."
Pamela stood up and ran toward the plane before Ben could react.
"Can't I come up too?"
"What ho, Pamma," Jeremy said. "Didn't expect to see you at a cricket match. I thought you were in Paris. But sorry, she's only a two-seater, and you're not exactly dressed for climbing into cockpits, however charming you look."
He left the rest of the sentence hanging.
"I'll come over and see you later, if I may," he added. "And if you like, I'll ask your pa if I may take you up in my new bird."
"Fine."
Pamela turned away and walked back to the pavilion, brushing against Ben in her annoyance.
"It's always a man's world in the end, isn't it?" she said.
"Ask my pa indeed.
Go on, then. Go up with him. Have a good time."
"I don't want to leave you on your own. I'm sure there will be other..." Ben mumbled.
"Oh, for heaven's sake, I know you're dying to go up in a plane," Pamela said. "Go on, go,"
and she gave him a friendly push. Feeling very self-conscious with the eyes of the village upon him, Ben walked out to the plane. Jeremy's face was bright with pleasure. Ben had seen that look many times before, usually when Jeremy had accomplished something utterly forbidden.
"I take it you passed your test," Ben said dryly. "With flying colours, old chap. The bloke said I was born to it. Well, I do have a falcon on my family crest, don't I? Come on, don't just stand there, hop in."
Ben climbed into the back seat.
"Don't I need a helmet or something?" Jeremy laughed. "If we crash, a bloody helmet's not going to do you much good. Don't worry. I got the hang of it in the first 5 minutes. Now it's a piece of cake."
The engine revved. The plane bumped over the grass, gaining speed until it rose into the air. They circled behind the pavilion and roared over the cricket pitch again, clearing the big copper beach at the bottom of the vicarage garden with a couple of feet to spare. The village of Elmsley spread out below them, built around the green, with the cricket pitch in the middle, the memorial to the Great War in its prominent place on one side, and St. Mary's Church with its fine perpendicular tower on the other. Below the right wing were the manicured gardens of Nethercote, Jeremy's home. The plain banked, and the town of Sevenoaks came into view, then the whole of Shoreham Valley, with the line of the North Downs curving to the south. The River Medway was a bright streak to their left, the Thames an even brighter one on the distant horizon. The wind whipped through Ben's hair. He felt exhilarated. Jeremy turned back to him.
This is the ticket, all right, isn't it? I can't wait for the big show to start. This is my idea of how war should be, a gentleman sort of war. Warrior against warrior, and the better man wins. You have to get your own license, old chap, then we can join up together.
Ben thought there was little point in mentioning that he couldn't afford to take flying lessons. Jeremy had never understood that money might be a problem. At Oxford, he was always inviting Ben on expensive jaunts to London shows or nightclubs, or even weekend trips to Paris. Jeremy would happily have paid for both of them, but Ben had too much pride to accept and had invented essays that had to be finished. Consequently, he had earned the reputation of a swot, which he wasn't, and brilliant, which he wasn't either. He had acquired a perfectly good second-class degree. Jeremy had scraped through with a third, but in his case it didn't matter. He was an only son and would inherit the title and all that went with it some day.
"So what do you think?"
Jeremy yelled.
"Absolutely smashing!" "I know, isn't it? Let's fly to France." "Have you got enough petrol?" "How should I know? I just bought the thing," Jeremy said, laughing.
But he banked the plane, swinging it back in a broad circle toward the village. There it was below them, the one main street of cottages leading to the green, surrounded by fields of hops and apple trees, so neat and green and typically English. Jeremy leaned over the side and pointed.
"Look, there's Farley. Doesn't it look orderly from up here? Capability Brown did a splendid job laying out those gardens."
He pushed on the joystick and the plane dropped as Farley Place, Pamela's ancestral home since 1600 and something, came into view ahead of them, a vast, square grey stone building set amid acres of parkland, with a curved driveway leading past ornamental flower beds, the lake on one side, the kitchen gardens beyond. Jeremy let out a whoop of delight.
"Look, Ben, they've got guests for tea. Let's give them a surprise, shall we?"
The plane banked sharply. Ben hung on and closed his eyes as land became sky. His stomach did a bank of its own. The plane circled lower and lower until it was flying over the lake with its island folly, then over the ride lined with horse chestnut trees from which they'd collected conkers as boys. A tennis court had been marked out on the back lawn, with tables beside it, and several figures in white seated while Soames the butler was serving tea.
"I reckon there's enough room to land right beside them," Jeremy shouted. "Too bad they're not wearing the sort of hats that will sail well when they blow off."
They made their approach along the south ride, with chestnut trees on either side of the wingtips. Ben was still too exhilarated to be scared. The flying instructor was right, Ben decided. Jeremy did fly as if he were born to it. The tea guests had risen to their feet when the plane burst from the trees. They backed up in alarm as the tablecloths flapped and napkins flew. The plane was now only feet from the ground, then only inches. Jeremy noticed the sundial at the same moment as Ben. It was standing, weathered and forgotten, in the middle of the east lawn. Ben opened his mouth to say,
"Watch out! There's a su—"
At the same moment as Jeremy yanked the joystick over hard to the right, the wing dipped, dug into the grass, and the plane flipped over. Part 1. Pamela. Chapter 1. Bletchley Park, May 1941. Lady Pamela Sutton stared at the dreary government-issued posters on the wall of her small cubicle in Hut 3. Some of them cheerful exhortations to do one's best, to soldier on with a stiff upper lip, and others dire warnings about letting the side down. Beyond the blackout curtains that covered the windows, dawn would be breaking. She could hear the chorus of birds in the woods beyond the hut, still chirping madly and joyfully as they had done before the war began, and would keep doing after it ended, whenever that would be. It had already gone on too long, and there was no end in sight. Pamela rubbed her eyes. It had been a long night, and her eyes were stinging with tiredness. According to civil service regulations, women were not supposed to work on the night shift with men, in case their morals were compromised. She had found this amusing when the shortage of male translators meant that one of the girls had to do night shift work. "Frankly, I don't think my honour is in danger from any of the chaps here," she had said. "They are more interested in maths problems than girls." But she had come to regret her bravado many times since. Night work was brutal. Thank God her shift was soon coming to an end and she could go to bed. Not that she could ever sleep properly during the day with trains rattling past her window. "Bloody war," she muttered and breathed onto her hands, trying to induce some warmth into her fingers. Although it was May, the huts were cold and damp overnight. The coke ration had been stopped on May 1st, but that wasn't entirely bad. The cast-iron stove smoked badly and spewed out noxious fumes. Everything was so horrible these days. No decent food to eat. Meals consisting of powdered eggs, canned corned beef, sausages that were more sawdust than meat. Her landlady obviously hadn't been much of a cook before the war, but what she cooked now was quite inedible. Pamela envied those on the day shift. At least they could take their main meal in the dining room, which was supposed to be quite good. She could go across and get some breakfast before she went off duty, but she was always too tired to eat by the end of a long night. At the outbreak of the war, she had been anxious to do something useful. Jeremy had joined up on the first day, welcomed into the RAF with open arms. He had been one of the most decorated pilots at the Battle of Britain, but then in typical Jeremy fashion, he'd strayed too far into France, chasing a returning German plane and been shot down. Now he was in the Stalag Luft, a camp for captured airmen, somewhere in Germany, and nobody had heard from him in months. She didn't even know whether he was alive or dead. She squeezed her eyes shut so that a tear couldn't form. "Stiff upper lip at all times," she repeated to herself. That was what was expected these days.
"We must set an example," her father had said in his normal thundering manner, pounding on the table for better effect. "Never let anyone see you are upset or afraid. People look up to us, and we have an obligation to show them how it's done."
It was for that very reason that she had been selected for this job. Her friend, Trixie Radcliffe, fellow Deb in the spring of 1939, had invited her for tea in London back in the early days of the war when civilized things like tea at Brown's Hotel still existed.
"I say, Pamma, this chap I know introduced me to another chap who might want to give us a job," Trixie had said in that enthusiastic way of hers. "He's looking for girls like us, from good families, no nonsense, nor prone to hysterics."
"Goodness, what kind of job is he offering? Deportment classes for the WAACs and Wrens?" Trixie had laughed.
"Nothing like that. I gather it's something rather hush-hush. He asked me if I could be trusted to keep my mouth shut and never gossip."
"Golly," Pamela looked surprised. Trixie leaned closer.
"He seems to think that we are brought up to do the right thing, hence will not let the side down and give away secrets.
He even asked me whether I drink a lot," she laughed. "I gather people are apt to spill too many beans when drunk."
"So what did you tell him?"
"That I'd only just come out before the war, and since rationing, I hadn't really had a chance to prove how well I hold my liquor."
Pamela laughed too, then her face grew serious again. "I wonder what he could possibly want us for. sending us as spies into Germany. He did ask if I spoke German. Actually, he said, did I have the German, which I first took to mean a German chap. I'm afraid I broke out in a fit of giggles. I told him we'd both been to finishing school in Switzerland and that you were a whiz with languages. He seemed really interested in you, by the way. Really perked up when I said I knew you.
Golly, Pamela said again. I don't think I can see myself as a spy, vamping German officers. Can you?
No, my sweet, I can't see you vamping Germans. You always were too pure. I, on the other hand, might be quite good at it. Unfortunately, my German is spoken with a decidedly English accent. They'd detect me as a phony in an instant. But I don't think it's spying. This chap also asked how good I was at crossword puzzles.
What a strange thing to ask, Pamela said.
Trixie leaned even closer until she was whispering in Pamela's ear.
I rather think it may be something to do with breaking codes and things.
And so it had proved to be. The two girls had taken the train from Euston Station to Bletchley Junction, an hour north of London. It was almost dark when they arrived. The station and the town were both unprepossessing. A pall of dust from the local brickworks hung over the air. There was nobody to meet the train, and they carried their own suitcases up a long path beside the railway line until they came to a high chain-link fence topped with barbed wire.
Crikey!
This time even Trixie was alarmed.
It certainly doesn't look very inviting, does it?
We don't have to do this, Pamela said. They stared at each other, each willing the other to bolt.
We can at least find out what they want us to do, and then say, no, thank you very much, but I'd rather be a land girl and raise pigs.
This put them both in better spirits.
Come on, let's face the music.
Trixie nudged her friend, and they walked up to the main gate. The RAF guard on duty in the concrete sentry box had their names on his clipboard, and they were directed to the main house, where they were to report to Commander Travis. Nobody offered to carry their bags, which more than anything told Pamela that they were now in a very different world from the one she was used to. The driveway passed rows of long, drab-looking huts before the main house came into view. It had been built by a nouveau riche family at the height of Victorian excess, and was a sprawling mixture of styles with fancy brickwork, gables and oriental pillars, and a conservatory sticking out of one end. New arrivals from lower down the social scale were often impressed, but to girls raised in stately homes, it produced the opposite effect.
"What a monstrosity!" Trixie exclaimed, laughing. "Lavatory Gothic, wouldn't you say?"
"But the view's pretty," Pamela said. "Look, there's a lake, and a copse and fields. I wonder if there are horses and one can go riding."
"It's not a house party, darling," Trixie said. "We're here to work. Come on, let's get it over with and find out what we're in for."
They entered the main house and found themselves in the sort of impressive interior they were used to. Ornately carved ceilings, panelled walls, stained glass windows and thick carpets. A young woman carrying a sheaf of papers came out of a side door and didn't seem surprised to see them.
"Oh, I suppose you're the latest lot of Debs," she said, regarding Trixie's mink collar with disdain. "Commander Travis is upstairs, second door on the right."
"Hardly the warmest welcome," Trixie whispered as they left their suitcases and ascended a rather grand carved oak staircase.
"Do you think we're making an awful mistake?" Pamela whispered. "A bit late to turn back now."
Trixie squeezed her hand, then stepped forward to knock on a polished oak door. Commander Travis, the deputy director, looked at them with clear skepticism.
This is no joyride, young ladies. In fact, it's bloody hard work. But I hope you'll find it's rewarding work. You'll be doing your part to stop the enemy. Just as important a job as our boys in the service are doing. And the first thing we stress here is absolute secrecy. You will be required to sign the Official Secrets Act. After that, you are not permitted to discuss your work with anyone outside your unit, not even with each other, not even with your parents or boyfriends. Is that clear?
The girls nodded. Then Pamela got up the courage to ask,
Exactly what will our work be? We've been told nothing so far.
He held up a hand.
First things first, young lady.
He produced two sheets of paper and two fountain pens.
Official Secrets Act. Read this and sign here, please.
He tapped a finger on the paper.
So you're saying that we have to promise never to divulge what goes on here before we know what goes on here?
Trixie asked. Commander Travis laughed.
You've got spirit. I like that. But I'm afraid once you came in through that gate, you became a security risk to the country, and I assure you that your work here will be a damned sight more interesting and rewarding than other jobs you could do.
Trixie looked at Pamela, shrugged, and said,
Why not? What have we got to lose?
She took the pen and signed. Pamela followed suit. Later, when she was alone, she discovered that she was to be sent to Hut 3 to translate decoded German messages. Pamela didn't know what Trixie was doing, as they were only allowed to share information with members of their own hut. But she knew that Trixie was annoyed that she hadn't been given a more exacting and glamorous job.
"Filing and typing in the index room. Can you imagine anything more boring?" she had said. "While one gathers, the men in the huts have all the fun working on strange machines. I'd never have come if I'd known I'd be doing boring, menial stuff. How about you? Is your job going to be menial, too?"
"Oh, no. I'm going to be chatting daily with Herr Hitler," Pamela said, then burst out laughing at her friend's face.
"A joke, darling. One has to keep up a sense of humour at all times. And yes, I'm sure my job will be utterly menial too. After all, we're not men, are we?"
And she had never told Trixie any more than that. She was horribly conscious of the importance of her job and that a failure to translate or a mistranslation might mean hundreds of lives lost. She realized that she was usually handed the lowest-level priority decodes and that the priority intercepts went to the men, but just occasionally she had the satisfaction of coming up with a hidden gem. The task had been challenging and exciting at first, but after a whole year she had become tired and jaded. The unreality of it all, the discomforts and the constant stream of bad news from the battlefields were beginning to wear down even a cheerful person like Pamela. The huts were horribly basic, freezing in winter, sweltering in summer, always gloomy with inadequate bare light bulbs hanging from the ceiling. And at the end of long shifts, she had to return to her billet, a dismal boarding-house room backed against the railway line. As she rode back into town on the ancient bike she had acquired, she found her thoughts turning to Farley in the spring, the woods a carpet of bluebells in the first week of May, young lambs in the fields, riding in the early morning with her sisters, and she found that she really longed to see her sisters, and she had to admit that she had never really been close to any of them, except for Margot, whom she hadn't seen in ages and missed terribly. They were all so different. Livy, 5 years her senior, had been born prissy and grown up, and was always telling the others how to behave properly. Pamela realized with regret that she hardly knew Phoebe, the youngest daughter.
She had seemed a bright little girl and had the makings of a splendid horsewoman, but spent most of her life in the nursery, away from the rest of the family. And then there was the annoying Dido, 2 years her junior, fiercely competitive and desperate to be grown up and out in society, to have everything Pamela had. But Dido saw her as a rival, never a partner in crime as Margot had been, and they had never shared the same intimacy. Pamela turned back to her work when a basket of transcripts was placed in front of her. The early morning messages were beginning to come in, which was good news. It meant that the brainy chaps in Hut 6 had got the Enigma settings right, and the resulting printouts were in real German, or at least vaguely understandable German. She picked up the first card. The Typex produced long strips of letters divided into groups of 5. X's were periods, Y's were commas, and proper names were preceded by a J. She looked at the first one. W-U-B-Y, Y-N-U-L-L, S-E-Q-N-U, L-L-N-U-L, L-X. This was something that came through every day. Wetter Bericht, the morning weather forecast for Sector 6, and Null meant nothing important was going on. She wrote out a quick translation and dropped it into the outbasket. The next one was equally routine. A-B-S-T-I, M-M-S-P-R, U-C-H-Y-Y, R-E-S-T-X, O-H-N-E-X, S-I-N-N. A test sending from a German command to make sure the day's codes were working. "Thank you, Hamburg. They are working very nicely," she said with a smile as she dropped this one into the basket. The next one had come through badly corrupted. Half the letters were missing. Messages were often received like this and required the skill used to solve a crossword puzzle as well as a good knowledge of the German terminology of war. Pamela managed to deduce that the subjects of the message were the 21st Panzer Division, part of Rommel's Desert Force. But the following letters, FF-I space G, had her flummoxed. Was it 2 words or even 3? If it was more than 1 word, then the first one might be Auf, meaning on. She stared harder until the letters danced in the poor light. She longed to remove the blackout curtains, but only the warden was allowed to do that at his appointed hour. Her eyes hurt. Rest, she thought. I need to rest. Then she was alert again, a hopeful smile on her face. She tried the letters Auffrischung. The 21st Panzer Division needed to rest and refit. She jumped up and almost ran through to the watchroom. Wilson, the older man who was watch chief, looked up with a frown. He didn't approve of women on his night shift and ignored Pamela as much as possible.
"I think I've got something interesting, sir," she said.
She put the Typex in front of him with her translation underneath. He stared at it, frowning for a long time before he looked up.
"Rather a stretch of the imagination, wouldn't you say, Lady Pamela?"
He alone always insisted on addressing her with her title. To the rest of them, she was P.
"But it could mean that the 21st Panzers might be withdrawn. That's important, isn't it?"
2 other men at the table leaned over to see what the fuss was about.
"She may be right, Wilson," one of them said. "Auffrischung. Good word."
He gave Pamela an encouraging smile.
"See if you can come up with something else that makes sense then, Wilson," the other said. "We all know her German is better than ours."
"You should pass it along to Army HQ anyway, just in case," the first said.
"Well done, P."
Pamela allowed herself a grin as she returned to her seat. She had just emptied her in-basket when voices at the other end of the hut signalled the arrival of the early day shift. Pamela took her coat from its peg.
"Lovely day out there," one of the young men said as he came toward her. He was tall and gangly, peering at the world through thick glasses. His name was Rodney, and he was the epitome of the studious young Oxford or Cambridge men who had been lured to work at Bletchley Park.
"Lucky you get time to enjoy it. Rounders match this afternoon, I gather. If you happen to like rounders, I'm a complete duffer at it myself, I regret. And country dancing tonight. But then you'll be working, won't you?"
He paused and ran a nervous hand through unruly hair.
"I don't suppose you care to come to the cinema with me on your night off?"
"Kind of you, Rodney," she said. "But frankly, on my night off, I'd rather catch up on sleep."
"You are looking a little hollow around the eyes," he agreed, never having shown himself to be tactful.
"These night shifts do get to one after a while, don't they? Still, all in good cause, so they say."
"So they say," she repeated. "I wish we could see that we're making progress. The country, I mean. All the news seems to be bad, doesn't it? And the poor people in London being bombed night after night. How long can we take it, do you think?"
"As long as we have to," Rodney said. "Simple as that."
Pamela looked at his retreating back with admiration. He represented the backbone of Britain at this moment, a skinny, awkward bookworm, yet determined to keep going for as long as it took to defeat Hitler. She felt ashamed of her own depression and lack of faith as she went to retrieve her bicycle and rode into town. Her digs at Mrs. Adams' boarding house were close to the station, and a train whistled as it approached the platform.
"If my parents could see where I'm living now," Pamela thought with a grim smile.
But then they had no idea where she was working or what she was doing. Under the Official Secrets Act, she was not allowed to divulge anything to anybody. It hadn't been easy to persuade her father to let her leave home, but she had turned 21 and come out into society, so he could hardly forbid her. And when she had said,
"I want to do my bit, Pa. You said it's up to us to set an example, and I'm setting one," he had reluctantly agreed.
She dismounted from her bike and wheeled it along the pavement. She felt sick with hunger and tiredness, but she sighed as she wondered what breakfast would await her today. The lumpy porridge made with water, bread fried in the drippings from last Sunday's scrag end of mutton, toast with a scrape of margarine and watery marmalade if they were lucky. And her mind drifted to the spread on the sideboard back at Farley, the kidneys and bacon and kedgeree and scrambled eggs. How long before she could go home? But if she went home, how would she force herself to come back? There was a newsstand outside the station, and a headline read, "Hero Comes Home." Pamela glanced at the front page on the pile of newspapers. Since the war began and paper was scarce, the print had become smaller and more crowded and the pictures tiny. But there, halfway down the front page of the Daily Express, she spotted a grainy photograph of a man in RAF uniform and recognised the jaunty grin. She fished in her pocket for tuppence and took the newspaper.
"Ace Pilot Flight Lieutenant Jeremy Prescott escapes against all odds from German prisoner of war camp. Only survivor of a breakout."
Before she could read any more, her legs buckled under her, and she sank to the ground. Instantly, there were people around her, arms lifting her up.
"Steady on, love. I've got you," one voice said.
"Bring her over to the bench, Bert, and someone go in the station cafe for a cup of tea. She's as white as a sheet."
It was the kindness more than anything that produced a great heaving sob from deep within Pamela. all the tension, the long nights, the hard work. The depressing news escaped from her in that one sob, and following it, the tears started streaming down her cheeks. She felt herself carried and placed gently on a seat. She found she was still clutching the newspaper.
"What was it, love? Bad news?" the woman at the newspaper stand asked.
Pamela's body was still shaking with sobs.
"No, it's good news," she managed to gasp at last. "He's alive. He's safe. He's coming home."
That afternoon she received a message to report to Commander Travis. Her heart skipped a beat. What could she have done wrong? Had someone reported the incident at the station? She was heartily ashamed and embarrassed about her complete lack of control. Pa would have been mortified, would have told her she had let the side down, and now she worried. Had she said something she shouldn't? She had heard rumours about people who had said too much, breached security. They disappeared and were never seen again. There were nervous jokes about where they had gone, but nobody laughed too much. The jokes might have been true. But then one was not summoned to the deputy director for everyday matters. She jumped on her bike and pedalled back to the campus. Commander Travis looked up from his paperwork as she came in. He motioned to the chair beside his desk. She perched on the edge of it.
"I hear you had a little trouble earlier today, Lady Pamela," he said.
The formality of her title in itself was worrying.
"Trouble, sir?"
"I hear you collapsed on the street outside the station. Are you not eating enough? I know the food is not exactly always appetizing."
"I'm eating enough, sir."
"The night shifts. They take their toll on the body, I know."
"But we all have to rotate and do our share. I don't enjoy them. I never seem to get enough sleep when I'm on night shift, but it must be the same for everyone else."
"You are quite well?" he asked,
giving her a knowing stare. He waited a second or two before he added,
"Do you have a particular attachment to one of our young men?"
She actually laughed then.
"I'm not pregnant, if that's what you're suggesting."
"You don't look like the fainting type to me."
He leaned closer to her across his desk.
"So what's up?"
"I'm sorry, sir. I feel so foolish. And you're right. I don't make a habit of doing that sort of thing."
He fumbled through her file.
"How long since you've taken leave?"
"I went home for a couple of days at Christmas, sir."
"Then you're overdue."
"But we're understaffed in Hut 3. It wouldn't be right to..."
"Lady Pamela, I expect our people to do first-class work. I can't have them cracking up on us. Take a week off."
"But there would be nobody to take my place, and we can't have..."
"When does your current rotation finish?"
"At the end of the week."
"Then work your rotation and go home then."
"Oh, but sir..."
"That's an order, Lady Pamela. Go home, have a good time, and come back refreshed."
"Yes, sir. Thank you."
It was only when she came down the steps of the big house that the full implication of this struck her. She would be going home, and Jeremy was safely back in Britain. He might already be at Nethercote. Suddenly, everything was right with the world.
Chapter 2. Farley Place, near Sevenoaks, Kent, May 1941. It was the gamekeeper's boy who spotted it first. He had been out at dawn checking the traps, since wartime rationing had meant that rabbit was on the menu even at the big house. It was a chore he had taken on willingly, loving the freedom and solitude of the countryside, still in awe of the wideness and greenness of it all, of the immense arc of sky like pale blue glass overhead. After the flat in Stepney and the alleyway with its small strip of grubby sky, Farley still seemed too improbable to be real. This particular morning, he was returning empty-handed. The gamekeeper suspected some village lads were helping themselves to the odd rabbit or partridge, and he talked of putting down man-traps. The thought of man-traps brought an added spice of excitement to the daily chore for the boy. He wondered how it would feel to see one of the bigger village boys caught in a trap, the boys who took delight in bullying him and pushing him around because he was a runt and an outsider. He quickened his stride for the cottage, his stomach growling for porridge and eggs, real eggs, not the powdered stuff that tasted like cardboard. It was going to be a warm and perfect early summer's day. Strands of mist lingered over the meadows, and a cuckoo was calling loudly, drowning out the dawn chorus of birds. The boy came out of the woods and into the parkland that surrounded the big house, looking out carefully for the herd of deer because he was still rather scared of them. Smooth green grass was dotted with spreading oaks, chestnuts and copper beeches, and beyond he caught a glimpse of the big house itself rising like a fairy-tale castle above the trees. He was about to take the path that led to the cottage when he saw something lying in the grass, something brown, and beside it, something long and light and flapping a little, like a large wounded bird. He couldn't imagine what it could be, and he went toward it cautiously, still conscious that the country was full of unexpected dangers. When he got closer, he saw that it was a man lying there, or had been a man. He was wearing an army uniform and lying face down, his limbs at improbable angles. From a pack on his back came strings, and the strings were attached to what looked like long strands of whitish fabric. It took him a while to realize that it was a parachute, or the remains of a parachute, because it lay there, limp and lifeless, torn and flapping pathetically in the breeze. The boy understood then that the man had literally fallen from the sky. He stood for a moment, wondering what to do, feeling slightly sick because the corpse was horribly damaged and the grass around it stained with blood. Before he could make up his mind, he heard the thud of hoofbeats on grass and the jingle of a bridle. He looked up to see a girl on a fat white pony galloping toward him. The girl was well turned out, in a velvet crash cap, jodhpurs, and hacking jacket, and as she came closer, he recognized her as Lady Phoebe, the youngest of the daughters from the big house. He realized with horror that she'd ride right into the corpse if he didn't stop her. He ran forward, waving his arms.
"Stop!" he cried.
The pony skidded to a halt, whinnied, danced, and bucked nervously, but the girl kept her seat well.
"What do you think you're doing?" she demanded. "Are you mad? You could have had me off. Snowball could have trampled you." "You mustn't go that way, miss," he said. "There's been an accident. You wouldn't want to see it."
"What kind of accident?"
He glanced back.
"A man fell from the sky. He's all smashed up. It's horrible."
"Fell from the sky?"
She was straining to see past him.
"Like an angel, you mean?"
"A soldier," he said. "I don't think his parachute opened."
"Golly, how horrid. Let me see."
She tried to urge the pony forward, but it was still snorting and dancing nervously. The boy stepped between her and the corpse again.
"Don't look, miss. You don't want to see things like that."
"Of course I do. I'm not squeamish, you know. I've watched the men butchering a hog. Now, that really was rather horrid, the way it screamed. I decided never to eat bacon again, but I happen to adore bacon, so that didn't last long."
She nudged the pony forward, making the boy step aside. The pony took a few nervous steps, then stopped, sensing that it didn't want to go any closer. Phoebe stood up in the saddle and peered.
"Crikey," she said. "We must tell somebody."
"We should tell the army blokes. He's one of them, ain't he?"
"Isn't he?" she corrected.
"Really, your grammar is awful."
"Bugger my grammar, miss, if you don't mind me saying so."
"I do mind, and it's not miss. I'm Lady Phoebe Sutton, and you should address me as my lady."
"Sorry," he said, swallowing back the word miss that was about to come out.
"We must tell my father," she said firmly. "It is still his land, after all. Even though the army is using it at the moment, it still belongs to Farley. Come on, you'd better come with me."
"To the big house, miss. I mean, m'lady."
"Of course. Pa is always up early. The rest of them will still be asleep."
He started to walk beside the pony.
"You're the boy who is staying with our gamekeeper, aren't you?" she asked.
"That's right. Alfie's me name. I came down from the smoke last winter."
"Smoke? What sort of smoke?"
He chuckled then.
"It's what us Cockneys call London."
She stared down at him critically.
"I haven't seen much of you on the estate."
"I'm at school in the village all day."
"How do you like it?"
"It's all right. The village kids pick on me 'cause I'm little for my age, and I ain't got no one to stick up for me."
"That's not nice."
He looked up at her haughty little face, a face that looked so content with itself, so secure.
"In case you haven't noticed, people aren't nice," he said. "There's a war on. Blokes are flying over London every night, dropping bombs and not caring who they kill. Women, children, old people. It don't matter to them. I saw a baby after a bomb had gone off, lying there in the street, looking as if there wasn't a mark on it. And I went to pick it up, and it was stone cold dead. And another time, a woman ran down the street screaming, and all her clothes had been blown off in the blast. And do you know what she was screaming? She was screaming, 'My little boy, he's buried under all that rubble. Someone save my little boy.'"
Phoebe's expression softened.
"You were sensible to come here, away from the smoke," she said. "How old are you?"
11, almost 12.
"I just turned 12, she said proudly. "I was hoping they'd send me to school when I was 13, but I don't think it will happen now, not with a war on. My sisters went to school, lucky ducks."
"You mean you haven't been to school yet?"
"No, I've always had a governess. It's so boring doing lessons alone. It was different for my sisters because they had each other, and they were naughty and played tricks on the governess. But I was an afterthought. Dido says I was an accident."
"Who's Dido?"
"My sister, Diana. She's 19. She's furious about the war because she was supposed to come out last year."
"Come out of what?"
Phoebe laughed, a rather fake and superior sort of ha-ha.
"You don't know anything, do you?
Girls like us have a season and are presented at court. We go to dances and are supposed to find a husband. But Dido's been stuck here instead, dying of boredom. The older ones all had their season."
"And got married?"
"Livy did. But she was always the good child, Dido says. She married boring Edmund Carrington, and she's already produced the heir."
"Heir?"
Alfie asked, making her laugh again.
"Not that sort of heir. I mean she's had the required son to inherit the title one day. Our parents couldn't manage a son, which means Farley will go to some remote cousin when Pa dies, and we'll all be turned out into the snow, Dido says. But I think she was teasing.
Things like that don't happen these days, do they? Especially with a war on.
She paused while Alfie digested this information, then continued.
But the others didn't quite obey the rules, much to Pa's fury. Margot went to France to study fashion in Paris and met a handsome Frenchman. She wouldn't leave when she had a chance, and now she's trapped in Paris, and we don't know what has happened to her. And Pama, well, she's really nice and very clever,